good afternoon, everyone. It's my pleasure to invite you to the latest in a series of podcasts called The Legal Listen. This is a BLG podcast series that explores key issues in law and business. My name is Cindy Clark, and I have the pleasure of serving as our national group head responsible for client sectors and new services. I'm delighted to be here with my colleagues and to welcome BLG's Eva Krajewska, Ira Pargi, and Dan McCulloch for a timely exploration of legal, privacy, and ethical considerations surrounding mandatory vaccination and, importantly, immunity passports. Now that Canada has COVID-19 vaccines, although they are fewer than we wish them to be at present, there has been significant discussion about equitable distribution protocols and, of course, what will happen when we have enough vaccine for all those who wish to have it and whether or not it ought to become mandatory and whether we will be required in future to demonstrate our immune or lack thereof status. So while these are new conversations, I think we've learned throughout the pandemic, it's really important and helpful to start thinking about these issues before they are immediately on the doorstep. So it's a wonderful timing from my point of view to be exploring these issues. Our group is perfectly well suited to do that. Eva is a partner in our public law group, providing strategic advice to businesses, institutions, and individuals who are facing or trying to avoid litigation. She has a very diverse practice, a significant component of which is appellate advocacy, and she's the co-chair of our group, and she's appeared in the Ontario Court of Appeal and numerous times before the Supreme Court for interveners. And Eva's been involved in all aspects of considering issues associated with the pandemic. Ira Pargi is counsel and member of our health law group and our cybersecurity, privacy, and data protection group. Ira advises clients on a host of information privacy and security issues, including breach response, and access to information. And given her expertise with health, is perfectly well suited to advise on issues and has the benefit of knowledge and experience with U.S. legislation as well. So delighted to have Ira with us this afternoon. And Dan is a partner with privacy and education sector experience, who's also very well known for his security and risk management work. And he's been focusing on assisting a wide range of employers, including hospitals, but also a number of education institutions with their COVID response policies. All three of our colleagues with us today, and myself included, have been engaged in every manner of pandemic and COVID issues since this first came upon us in late February 2020. So without further introduction, let's hear from our panelists. I thought it would be valuable to start the conversation by having each outline some of the key legal and ethical implications of a mandatory vaccine policy, and importantly, thinking about the potential for immunity passports that may follow. Eva, why don't you get us started?
Thanks, Cindy. I'll start off by kind of mapping out some of the issues that we would want to discuss. I think first we have to think about, if we're making vaccines mandatory or creating vaccine passports or immunity passports, the first question is, who is going to do that? Is it going to be the government who's going to do that? Is it going to be employers who are going to do that? And the analysis is a bit different whether it's the government or an employer. If we have immunity passports, it's probably going to raise a host of different issues, whether it's equality or privacy, and human rights issues or charter issues. We know that the concept of immunity passports is evolving, and it's being chatted about across the world. There are countries who are planning to do this, both at a government level, and there are kind of employers who are looking at doing this, whether it's airlines or certain types of places where we, cruise ships, you know, those kinds of areas where we know that there are concerns about COVID spread. And I think we also know that the courts have approached these issues during the pandemic a bit differently than maybe previously. I mean, the courts are not immune from being influenced by what is happening on the ground, the science. And we have seen courts give deference to government decision makers around their response to the pandemic. So that's, I think there's a lot to discuss at different levels of decision making, and they will each raise their own issues for both the public and employers.
That's a really helpful overview to give us a sense. There's certainly a myriad of issues. Ira, what are your reflections on this?
So it's interesting because I've been thinking a lot about this idea of the immunity passport, because from a privacy point of view, I think it raises some really novel questions. And the foundational question that I don't think anyone has a clear answer to yet is, if we are going to have immunity passports, what are they going to look like? How are they going to work? Because how we answer those questions will really drive how we think about any privacy considerations. So one model would be to have a big repository of information about vaccinations, some sort of government-run database that houses information about everyone who gets vaccinated. And that way, if someone wants to check if another person's been vaccinated, so for instance, if my employer wanted to know if I received the vaccine, they would look me up in that database to get the information. And, you know, on the one hand, there's a lot of intuitive sense to that. But from a privacy point of view, I think the worry with that model is that's a lot of information. You know, it's a lot of sensitive information about the health of possibly millions of people or thousands, depending on how we organize it, all housed in one spot. And any concentration of sensitive data in one spot is going to raise questions. Who's going to have access to the information? How are they going to be allowed to use it? For what purposes? How will we monitor their access and use? How will we keep that information secure? So, you know, that leads me to another thought that people have been bouncing around when it comes to immunity passports, which is letting people carry around their own, you know, some sort of paper or digital proof that they've been vaccinated. And, you know, on the one hand, again, it's very simple and intuitive. Many of us have little paper vaccination records that we've had since we were kids. And they tell us, you know, what shots we received, when and where. The challenge here, though, especially when we're talking about something that has unfortunately become a bit politicized like COVID has, is it really contains more information than maybe it needs to. So, you know, I don't think my employer would need to know if I got my vaccination at a health clinic for low-income people. I don't think a restaurant owner needs to know how old I am or if I have a medical condition that precludes me from getting the vaccination. So the worry with this model is, are we making people share more information than they really need to? And so finally, and this is sort of where I get to in stage three of my thinking, Cindy, and I think this picks up on some of what Eva was saying, is there are a lot of interesting discussions happening now about digital immunity passports. And the idea is, what if I could load proof of my vaccination into an app on my phone and I show that digital proof to my employer? Or I provide proof of my vaccination and in return I get some sort of digital confirmation code that I can carry around and it entitles me to go to my office or enter a restaurant or take a flight, whatever I want to do. And so here I don't have to disclose any extra information beyond what the person needs to know. All they need to know is, have I been vaccinated? And that's all I have to tell them. So, you know, from a privacy point of view, I think it's a really clean option. It's, of course, going to raise questions like, what if I don't have a phone? What if we don't have widespread ways for people to get this technology? But I think it's a pretty good starting point for discussion. And as I said, we know there are industries and tech developers working on this kind of technology. So I think it's going to be really interesting to see where things go on that front.
Thank you. It's I still am struck by the order of magnitude of the task, whether it's the creation of all kinds of new paper, which seems hard to believe in this day and age, or whether it's some sort of digital coding system. Dan, let's hear your thoughts on this.
Why don't I make the point that I think employers may need to know about their employees' vaccination status. So if, you know, and they may need good proof of that somehow. And that clearly is a government role that will have to be filled in a way that is reasonable and appropriate. That doesn't mean in my own mind that employers can make or are likely to be able to make vaccination mandatory. And I can explain briefly, but if I'm an employer, I may need to know that my employees are vaccinated because, for example, if they're not, I'm going to ask them to work at home for the next 2 months, right? Maybe not forever. Mm-hmm. I may allow them to come into the workplace, but if they can't present proof that they've been vaccinated, I may require them to wear a mask. So I do see scenarios where employers can ask ask the question and demand, again, good proof. That's a lot different than the word mandatory, which is being used a lot now in some of the public conversations. When I hear that word, I think of the concept of saying to an employee, you really can't work at all unless you get vaccinated. And I have trouble in my own mind tying that to a work-related safety purpose, because there are so many other ways to keep people safe. And we've quite fabulously discovered them all through working in the last 10 months. So I think truly mandatory is going to be a bit of a stretch for employers, but they will need to certainly know about vaccination status.
Well, I think that certainly brings to the fore in my mind, listening to the whole equality issue. And I don't know if you're the same, but it just strikes me as even having the requirement to apply to your employer and give them that kind of information, I can see your point that why it may well be needed in and of itself is going to create some challenges.
Yeah, I mean, we know that not everyone is going to be able to be vaccinated once we have enough supply. There will be people who will legitimately not be able to have the vaccine for medical reasons or other reasons. And so what happens to those people from kind of, and if, as Dan says, your employer asks you to provide proof of vaccination, fine. But then if you say, well, I can't be vaccinated, then the employer would have to try to accommodate you in some other way. So, you know, work from home. What if you work in an industry where you can't work from home? I think a lot of those issues are going to also be driven around the evolving science around what we know about the vaccine and whether it actually reduces transmission of the virus or whether it is just protective against hospitalization and acute illness. We don't know whether the vaccines reduce transmission as of yet. I think we will find that out with more data on the ground with countries reaching higher levels of immunization. But it does create an equality problem. So the equality problem could be either analyzed from an employer perspective, a kind of a human rights perspective of whether the employer is allowed to deny people access to their place of employment, or if not an employment perspective, from an access to a business. You know, you can't attend this restaurant without showing me proof of immunization. You can't go to the supermarket. You can't board this plane. I mean, we know that businesses are allowed to control access to their business, but it's going to raise an equality problem. Are we going to be excluding certain people from public places as a result of that? It also raises, if the government makes it mandatory, if the government issues orders, you can't go to the movie theater. There's a whole other analysis under the charter around the government creating prohibitions around entering public space, and also raising equality issues and potential, people who have medical reasons not to be immunized, whether that creates discrimination against people with disabilities. So it is going to raise issues for the human rights codes and potentially a charter. And I think we're going to have to see how those will be worked through the system. And again, that's why I think Dan's caution about making things mandatory. I mean, once you make things mandatory, they just attract so much more legal scrutiny than if you just encourage them, facilitate them, make them easier to attain.
Helpful. Dan, what do you think about that? And I wonder, as we think about all these things, whether
all might look different because of this pandemic. So some of the traditional approaches and, you know, masks might be an example of how they were viewed and now how they're viewed, how they were viewed last January or February, February 2020, and how we think about masks today.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's all about proportionality, I think, when you talk about this issue, whether that's a human rights justification for imposing a burden on someone with a disability, or whether it's under privacy legislation. The test is remarkably similar, is that if you're going to impose a disadvantage on someone, you have to be prepared to justify it as, you know, simplifying, proportional, based on some legitimate interest. And the interest here is, this is probably worth pointing out too, it has to be rooted in environmental safety. I think if you're an employer or a facility owner who's keeping someone out, and like Eva said, the science is really not conclusive right now. And in a sense, all of this policy that we're talking about is based on an assumption about the effect of the positive effect of vaccination on environmental safety. That could be challenged, you know, if you take a mandatory hard approach without lots of different options. What really may be driving all this, and this gets to a comment Eva made earlier, is when we talk about vaccination, we of course care about environmental safety, but what we care more about is public safety, getting the economy back going, you know, we care more about the public good, and I don't think we've ever seen that as a justification for hard limits than employers, for example, put on their employees. It's usually about kind of more tangible safety related concerns in the workplace rather than some greater public good. The greater public good typically falls to government, obviously.
Interesting. Well, I think it'll be, I think the governments will be challenged. And I think just even resources wise, I think about what it would take, Ira, just thinking about the idea of your digital, something that is a confirmation or at least gives indication of status, but doesn't disclose much more, and what would it would be required to even create such a thing. One wonders where the resources would come from to do that. Assuming if we pick up on Dan's point that government should have, I don't know if you said this, Dan, but I'll interpret for you that public good initiatives ought to be driven by government and not business or employers.
Yeah, and you know, a couple of thoughts in just listening to everyone talk. I agree with you that it will take not just resources, but actually a will to set up some sort of governance framework around all of this to control, you know, who will be able to require someone to produce their immunity passport, in what circumstances, for what purposes, how do we make sure they're using the information properly, all those kinds of things. And, you know, I think in general, we always think about those governance and privacy considerations as an afterthought, especially when we're trying to address an important social issue as we are here. So I agree with that. I think that can certainly be done. I don't think it's a deal breaker, but I'll be the first to dance in the streets if people actually think about those issues ahead of time. And you know, the other thought I had just listening to Dan and Eva talk about this idea of conditioning access to things based on whether a person has a vaccination is, you know, this is really a very big public health challenge of the kind we haven't seen for a long time. And one of the issues that's getting a lot of attention, quite rightly, from a public health point of view is we need to deal with the fact that there are not just individuals, but entire communities that view vaccination and the public health apparatus and the healthcare system with distrust. And there are all kinds of reasons for that. But it is what it is. And, you know, I think to Dan's point, the moment we start using really blunt tools like mandates and requirements, we lose those folks completely instead of trying to go the path of education and outreach and building trust. And that's something I worry about a lot in the context of, you know, discussion of mandatory vaccination, immunization passports, all those kinds of things. It's there will be folks left behind, and we can't just leave them behind.
I think what you're saying is absolutely right, that this is a huge public health problem and require kind of government leadership to create the appropriate governance frameworks around it. And I think a lot of industries are hoping that the government will do that. I mean, I think it's hard, the airline industry is probably looking for the government to get guidance on immunization and other issues, because that's an industry that has really suffered during the pandemic, and they want to be able to provide their service safely to the public and the public to have confidence that they can fly again. And so, and when we talk about the charter, we often talk about, just like Dan said in the human rights codes, we talk about proportionality. And for the government to take away a person's rights, to infringe a person's rights, the government can do that so long as they have a pressing and substantial objective. And here the governments do have a pressing and substantial objective, the pandemic. And we have seen court decisions where persons or businesses have challenged parts of the pandemic response, and the courts have often deferred to the government. But the government's burden is to show that there is a pressing and substantial objective, and that they have used tools that are proportional to achieving that objective, that they're properly tailored to it, that the government hasn't overreached. So there may be a big question about whether the government would have overreached by making vaccinations mandatory. My devil's advocate point is that I am worried, based on the last year, that when we provide guidance, we do not have sufficient compliance. I mean, we saw that with masks. A lot of people were, oh, it's nice to wear a mask, but we didn't have kind of the sufficient level of compliance until they were made mandatory. I think we see that with quarantine. I mean, we had supposedly mandatory quarantine for incoming travelers, and we know that people have not been properly quarantining, because we have the introduction of these new variants, and now the government is making 3 days mandatory quarantine in a hotel. I mean, so I just worry that I am usually the kind of person who favors a public education approach, outreach, and all of those things. And I think that stuff is incredibly important to get buy-in. But I think we also need to kind of demonstrate the severity of the situation and really try to get 60, 70, 80% of the population immunized. And some of that is, I think, is maybe it'll be more helpful for that to happen as you see more people getting the vaccine, as the vaccine becomes more accessible, as it becomes much more normalized. But I do worry that a only carrot approach may not be sufficient.
Well, and do we have examples of that? There are countries, I think of a few, who may be a bit further ahead, who may be thinking about or implementing some of these either mandatory policies and or the idea of the immunity passport. Or if we look back in history, is there anything that strikes you as something we might look to or our governments might be encouraged to consider?
So yes and no. I mean, there are a lot of historic examples where people had to show that they had received certain vaccinations to be allowed to travel, for instance. Schools require proof of immunization, and they allow for exemptions, but it is a generally enforced rule. So I think there are those examples. Unfortunately, I think this has gotten so politicized that it's automatically become much harder to do this. And I'm curious to know what others think on the issue. That we have heard, for instance, of a law firm that's requiring proof of immunization for people who want to go back to work and things like that. But I'm not aware of it happening at the government level elsewhere.
If I can jump in, I don't think the immunity passport idea is all that radical. I think the privacy advocates will say that the fear is that government becoming the bearer of everybody's identity and using that for some secondary or improper purpose. I'm not sure that's so different than what we see already. I mean, our most reliable proof of age, for example, is our driver's licenses, right?
Very true.
That's a government database, right? And age is certainly a significant part of our identities. So I think we do need a valid source of proof of vaccination, and government seems to be the right entity for that. Perhaps it should be legislated and locked down, and so we have transparency and clear controls and limitations. And if it does that, again, it enables employers to and other members of the public to make policy that deals with the risk, right? Ira, you mentioned the example of the law firm that says don't come to the office if you're not immunized. I personally don't have a problem with that policy at all. I think it makes a lot of sense, but it needs proof of vaccination to work well.
Yeah, agreed.
Well, and I guess, Eva, one of the issues, and maybe it's a whole timing question for this conversation, because I think about, Ira, your point about the populations and groups within our society who are very hesitant about vaccines and maybe highly skeptical for a bunch of arguably legitimate reason. And of course, we're at the moment in a situation of vaccine scarcity. So I wonder, on the one hand, how long it will take us to get to a place where we can really have a meaningful discussion about this, because I think it has to be, presumably, I don't know if you guys all agree, but available to all who want it before we get into being concerned about those who don't. But then at the same time, the longer that takes, I fear the longer that leaves us in a potential limbo around re-engaging with so many aspects of our society that are important to so many and to our businesses, and being able to gather in large spaces with other individuals, thinking about sort of, you know, universities and colleges come to mind as places where many people are used to gathering. So, you know, I think there's a balance of timing here as well. I don't know what you think about that.
I agree with you. I think, it may be a bit of a staged approach. I agree that kind of on a large scale, we can't make vaccine mandatory until we know that it's accessible to everybody, right? So I mean, I think if, you know, if BLG told me today, you can't come in because you don't have a vaccine, I'm like, but nobody does. You don't want anybody to come in. But, you know, it may be that in sectors where the vaccine, where there is high risk and the vaccine was made available to all the people in that specific sector and people chose not to get it, then the analysis may be a bit different. But I think at large, we do have to wait until there is more vaccine available to everybody before we can make such policies. I think I think the public education around this and what it looks like is going to be crucially important. And I think there's a lot of groups and different communities who are trying to do their best to educate people who may be vaccine hesitant. I also think making the vaccine just more accessible to people, we've already seen increase the number of people who take the vaccine. So even in the rollout of the vaccines to long-term care workers, once the vaccines came to long-term care homes, we saw many more long-term care workers getting the vaccine, right? And I think that just mm-hmm. shows that when it's at your place of employment, it's right there, everybody's doing it, we have a much higher uptake. If you live at, you know, Shepherd and Steeles, and you have to come down to the Metro Toronto Convention Centre to get a vaccine and take a day off work, that's going to be much more difficult.
Yeah, interesting. Well, and I think that sort of goes again to then whether there will need to be incentives and or really careful thought about how the vaccine is rolled out and hopefully made widely available when we're in that situation to those who want to participate in it. I guess I know we have to close out shortly, and I just want to bring it back to this idea, some of the ideas raised at the beginning. As you mentioned, Eva, so many issues ignited by this conversation, but thinking about again, this digital, and you, Dan, you've talked about the databases that already exist, but I guess I wonder with some final thoughts on where, what you experts think, and particularly our privacy experts here, where do you think the balance is going to land, or are we in a position yet to sort that out of privacy versus this public good, and where do you think that kind of privacy concern fits in? And I'm thinking as well about these tech companies and who may want to overtake government and developing different apps and different means of saying, here, we can get this for you and we'll create all these funky things to make it easy for you to demonstrate your immune status.
So I'm pretty optimistic, actually. You know, I think about the example of COVID screening apps. There were, and still are, many companies in the private sector developing these kinds of technologies. And, you know, government has played a role in picking some and disseminating them and having education around them and all that sort of thing. But it hasn't been seen as an either-or proposition. And I think that's helpful. And you know, the other thing that I kind of feel like the privacy issues are manageable if we have the will. I think we can set up the right framework and the right governance system to make sure that things unfold the way they should. We tend to be lazy about it, but I think we can do it. I worry more about the other issues, especially the equity issues and the rollout issues. To me, those are more worrying than the privacy piece. And I say that, you know, as someone who gets worked up on these issues for a living, I'm really not so troubled from a privacy perspective. It's all the other stuff that makes me lose sleep. I don't know what you think, Dan.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think the problem of storing and keeping a secure record of vaccination status and making that accessible to others as good proof is quite solvable. And I think we'll solve that. And I agree with you. It's what we do with that proof in our society that raises the really interesting questions. And you know, I think buy and hold there, as I've communicated, I think we'll use it to a limited degree to push people into one control or another, but not necessarily exclude them from things in a way that's really harsh or punitive.
I just add that based on the federal government's response to the pandemic and how carefully it calibrated the contact tracing app and how much discussions it engaged with privacy experts before it deployed that app, I think the government takes very seriously the privacy concerns. So if it's being rolled out federally, I could see them taking probably a similar approach. So I agree with Ira and Dan that maybe the privacy issues are not as concerning as other issues in the vaccine rollout.
Well, thank you all for those reflections and in many ways, I would say inspiring thoughts, both in terms of your confidence in our ability to manage this and in our ability to sort of put the priority where it ought to be, I think, on the public good. And I look forward to future conversations. It's evident that there are a myriad of issues, legal and otherwise, that are going to arise. And I hope that we can pick this up again in a short while and see where some of these issues are at. So thank you very much, Eva, Ira, and Dan. Much appreciate being with you this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.